talking about orthogonal functions and Green's functions. So we'll finish up our discussion of Green's functions and study orthogonal functions, which arise as solutions to the differential equation we solved last time, Ly equals F, in the case where L is self-adjoint. So for the most part, we'll focus on one case that we looked at last time. And so just to recall what we did before, so Sturm-Liouville problem, I'll use a slightly different notation this time compared to last time, but it's the same thing we saw, is to solve this family of differential equations. In an interval. For both the eigenfunctions u lambda and the eigenvalues u lambda. And so we saw before that this differential operator is formally self-adjoint with respect to the unit weight. Where S and T are positive functions. So this families of differential equations of this form arise commonly, for instance, if you're solving a differential equation in more than one variable and you use separation of variables. In that case, lambda would be the separation constants. And I say it's a family of differential equations because we can change lambda, and then we're changing the differential equation we're solving. OK, so I claimed last time that if we apply the correct boundary conditions, this self-adjoint differential formally self-adjoint differential operator becomes truly self-adjoint. And in that case, it behaves like a self-adjoint matrix. Which has orthogonal eigenvectors. So let's see why, if omega is truly self-adjoint, that the eigenvectors, eigenfunctions in this case, are orthogonal. So we can see that rather simply just by multiplying our differential equation by a different eigenfunction. So if we multiply by, say, u rho and integrate, we get this equation. And similarly, we could take the differential equation for u rho and multiply by u lambda. And in that case, we'd get if we subtract the two, what do we get? So we just get u rho omega u lambda with respect to the unit weight, the inner product of these two, minus the inner product of omega u rho with u lambda, again with respect to the unit weight, is equal to minus lambda minus rho times the inner product of u rho with u lambda with respect to the weight w. So if omega is truly self-adjoint, then the left-hand side should vanish. And in that case, if lambda is different from rho, we should have that the inner product on the right-hand side vanishes. So okay, so we get orthogonal solutions just as we expect. And so last time, we derived Lagrange's identity for omega. And the following homogeneous boundary conditions will make Q vanish on the boundary. So if we just set alpha A YA plus alpha B YB equal to 0. And similarly, for B, with the sum of the squares of alpha and beta positive, then and Q evaluated at A and B is 0 from before. It's fairly straightforward to show, so I'm not gonna do it on the board. It's a little bit cute. The expression for Q is a bit messy, so.
Is there supposed to be B in the argument of 3 of them?
No, this one should be A. Thank you. And this would be an A. And there should be some betas here, yes. These should be betas. Okay. So now that should make sense. Yes.
Okay. Are you use real yet?
Yeah, they were there. Otherwise, we'd need some complex conjugates. Yes.
So, is the case for that operator? Or?
No, I'm specializing to the case where we're restricting to real functions. But, yeah, if we just threw in some complex conjugates, the same argument would work. Yeah. 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 There's no reason I took off the star and can just throw that back in. Okay. So with these boundary conditions, the operator omega is self-adjoint. And so we learn a lot about the solutions. So first of all, the eigenvalues are real and distinct.
And sorry, can I just ask what is Q?
So Q is the right-hand side of Lagrange's identity. So we last time we had.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
So with these boundary conditions, the eigenvalues are real and distinct. So we can order them, and there'll be a smallest one.
Why can't we have the generated value?
So if we did, it's not obvious from what I've said, but there are some more properties we'll see that would not make sense if there were degenerate eigenvalues. So, yeah. And the U lambda n's form an orthonormal basis. Of L2 AB with weight W. So that means that so we can choose a normalization of these functions so that integral of U lambda n x U lambda m of x W of x dx is the Kronecker delta m and m. So that's what you'd expect based on the analogy with finite dimensional matrices. Furthermore, there are two extra properties that are special to these operators. And so one of those is that the zeros of U lambda n plus 1 are in between 0s of U lambda n. So if we say this is A and this is B, and this is U2, then U3 will have a zero here in this range. Then U3 has three zeros. And it will have one in between A and the first zero of U2. And it will have a second zero in between here and a third zero over here. So it could look something like this. And a related fact is that U lambda n has exactly n distinct zeros in AB. So these last two facts are follow from Sturm's separation and comparison theorems, and so. These wouldn't make sense if eigenvalues weren't distinct. So the first three of these points. Even if we relax some of these conditions. For instance, we assumed the coefficients in our differential operator were positive, but if S is 0 at A or B, still works. Or if A or B is infinite, it also still works. So if A or B is infinite, imposing those boundary conditions up there is not the most convenient thing to do. All we need to do is demand that U lambda is in L2 of AB, point W, and U lambda is finite at A or B, and the square root of W times U goes to 0 as X goes to plus or minus infinity.
Is U lambda is finite or
infinite? It's finite.
It's finite.
It is finite.
For the second condition there, as X goes to plus or minus infinity, is that for both or just for the infinite?
Just for whichever
okay.
Endpoint is infinite. So let's look at an example and see how this works. So Hermite's equation. So we'll choose AB to be minus infinity and infinity. So we don't need boundary conditions. Hermite's equation is H lambda double prime minus 2x H lambda prime is equal to minus 2 lambda H lambda. And this is not in the form of a Sturm-Liouville equation directly. So the this is an x, sorry. The coefficient of the first derivative term is not related to the coefficient of the second derivative term in the correct way. But I claimed that we can always put any second order differential equation in Sturm-Liouville form. And to do that, we can multiply it by g of x. Some unknown function g of x. If we do that, what do we get? We get g h lambda double prime minus 2x h lambda prime times g equal to minus 2 lambda g h lambda. And we want to compare that with our Sturm-Liouville equation, which was S H double prime plus S prime H prime plus T H is equal to minus lambda times W times H. And so comparing we see that, looking at the second derivative term, S of x is equal to g of x. And if we look at the term with no derivatives, that involves lambda, we see that g has to be equal to w. And if we look at the first derivative term, we see that minus 2x g has to be equal to s prime. Yes, thank you. And since we know S is equal to G, this gives us a differential equation we can solve for G of X. And so the solution is just G of X is a constant times e to the minus X squared. And we don't care about the constant, so that just normalizes our functions. And so we see g of x is equal to e to the minus x squared, and so is w of x. So this tells us that the solutions to this equation are orthogonal with respect to the weight e to the minus x squared. And since we haven't been careful about normalizing them, we need to put in a normalization constant here.
Where? Comparing the equation on the left and with the storm reversal form.
Yes.
Should it be like 2g equal omega?
Oh, omega is the operator. So
no, little w.
W.
Yeah, sorry.
Yes, there should have been a factor of 2 here. Thank you.
2g equal.
2g is, okay. It's 1/2. Okay, so then. But I haven't been careful about the normalization, so it doesn't matter. Thank you. OK. So in the notes, there's some more details connecting this equation to the solution of the quantum harmonic oscillator. And so we can see, just using these facts, that many of the familiar properties of the quantum harmonic oscillator arise, but I won't go through that now. So we can get through the other things I wanted to talk about. So if we have a complete set of orthonormal functions, we can use those to construct Green's functions. How does that work? Let's suppose L has a complete set of orthonormal eigenfunctions. Phi n, the eigenvalues. lambda n. So this could be the Sturm-Liouville operator or some other operator. So if we want to solve the equation we studied last time, Ly equals F, we can expand. So we can write y of x is a sum of some coefficients times the eigenfunctions, and f is, again, some sum of some different coefficients times the eigenfunctions. So that's what we mean by a complete set, is we can write any function as a sum like this. So if we substitute these expansions back into our differential equation here, what do we get? Just get L times the sum of alpha n phi n is equal to the sum 1 to infinity beta n times phi n, which, using the fact that these are eigenfunctions, gives us the sum alpha n lambda n phi n. So L phi is just lambda phi. And since the phis are linearly independent, the only way we can satisfy this equation is if alpha n lambda n is equal to beta n. Now, if all of the lambda n's are non-zero, then we can use beta n is the inner product of phi n with f. So this equation just comes from, if we take this equation and multiply both sides by phi m, and then integrate, only one term over here will survive. So the term with n equals m. So we get this relation. And so then we can use this relation in our expression for y of x. And using this expression for beta n, we get this expression. And if we exchange the sum and the integral, what we get is y of x is the integral, the sum, n equals 1 to infinity, 1 over lambda n, phi n of x, phi star n of x prime, f of x prime, dx prime. And that gives us a familiar looking expression You've got the integral of something that depends on x and x prime times f of x prime. So that something is just a Green's function. So we've constructed a different representation for the Green's function. This one is less frequently useful in practice for actually constructing them, but occasionally it is.
This is not symmetric in x and x prime.
This expression.
The Green's function is not the star?
Well, so the star is here. If we haven't used the fact that we haven't demanded that L is self-adjoint. If it is self-adjoint, then it will have real eigenfunctions, and then it will be symmetric. So we're not, so we're guaranteed that it has a complete set of real orthonormal eigenfunctions if it is self-adjoint, but we could perhaps construct one even if it's not self-adjoint.
You could use another weight for the inner product.
In which step part?
There, we're right at the inner product is. It's one. I mean,
yes, I've assumed the weight here is one, but we could, in principle, we could use a different weight. Yeah. Okay. So, we've got a completely different way of constructing the Green's function. Okay. So I want to spend the next little part of class going through some of the properties of orthogonal polynomials. These are a particularly important class of orthogonal functions that show up repeatedly. And we'll just go through a few of the, we won't really talk about particular orthogonal polynomials. We'll just go through a few properties that these class of functions all share. These will be useful. So, polynomials form a complete basis of L2 of AB with respect to the weight W. So it's probably a familiar fact to you when the weight is 1, it's also true when the weight is not 1. However, they're not the simple basis that you might pick. 1x squared is not orthogonal in general with respect to for arbitrary choices of a, b, and w. It's not orthogonal. So, if we want to construct from a complete basis an orthogonal basis, we can use the familiar Gram-Schmidt procedure. And so we'll start with an order 0 polynomial, which we can choose to be 1. And if we want this to be orthonormal, we should divide by the norm of 1. And suppose we've already constructed n orthogonal polynomials. We can get a degree n plus 1 polynomial from previous ones by multiplying the degree n polynomial by x. Now, if we want this polynomial to be orthogonal to all of the polynomials of degree n or less, then we should subtract off the projection of our new polynomial, xpn, along all of the previous directions. So subtract off the sum from I equals 0 to n of pi, pi times the inner product of pi with xpn with respect to weight w. And if we want these to be orthonormal, we should divide by some normalization factor, which is just the norm of the numerator. Now, what does this tell us? So this equation actually immediately implies a recursion relation in about two lines, because pi, inner product of pi with xpn, is just the integral from a to b of w pi xpn. We can also write as the integral from a to b dx w xpi n, which is just the inner product of x pi with pn, which is 0 for I less than n minus 1. By construction. So we assumed that Pn was orthogonal to all polynomials of degree less than n. So this sum with n terms actually only has, or n plus 1 terms, actually only has two terms. So only the term with n I equals n minus 1, or n, contribute. And so this gives us a recursion relation. And there are some coefficients that depend on which particular polynomial we're dealing with. All of the orthogonal polynomials satisfy recursion relations. Many other orthogonal functions do as well. OK, so one other useful equation we can come up with for orthogonal polynomials is an explicit formula for them. And along the way of constructing an explicit formula for the orthogonal polynomials, we'll actually, or I'll do part of it in lecture and you'll finish it up in tutorial, we'll actually end up classifying all possible orthogonal polynomials on the real line. So how can we construct them explicitly? So what do we want? We want to find some Pn so that this integral is 0 for p 0 up to n minus 1. And we'll construct an explicit formula by inspired guessing and checking. So we can guess a solution. But to do that, it's first useful to look at some simple cases. So let's look at the case n equals 1, p equals 0. So in that case, our equation just reads integral from a to b, p1 w dx equals 0. And one way we can satisfy this equation is if w p1 is proportional to the derivative of some function I call y1, where y1 at a and at b is 0. So remembering that we want p1 to be a degree 1 polynomial, there's only one obvious guess for something whose derivative is a degree 1 polynomial and it vanishes at a and b. So we can choose y1 to be proportional to x minus a times x minus b. Okay. Let's look at one more case before we jump to the general case and guess the solution. Okay, so n equals 2. Equals 1. We want integral of p2 w x dx be 0. And if we choose w times p2 to be the second derivative of y2, and y2 has double roots at a and b, then we'll satisfy this equation, and p2 will be a degree 2 polynomial. To see that, we can just integrate by parts. So we get integral ab d squared dx squared y2 x dx is p dx y2 x ab minus integral ab d dx y2 dx. So both of these vanish at a and b. And so it works. So we can sort of see a pattern here. And in general, if we choose w Pn be proportional to the nth derivative of yn with yn proportional to x minus a, x minus b to the n, then this integral vanishes as we want it to. Okay, so that we've guessed a solution for A and B finite. This doesn't quite work if A or B is infinite, but we can modify the idea without too much work to account for that case. So suppose A is minus infinity and B is finite. Then, if we choose yn to be x minus b to the n, that takes care of that boundary. And we just throw in some other function, fn, where such that yn still goes to 0. At minus infinity, faster than then it still works. And similarly, if B infinity, A finite, or A is minus infinity, B is infinity. So we've guessed a solution for what Pn should look like. And so our solution is that Yn is proportional to s to the n of x, Fn of x, with s of x equal to x minus a, x minus b, a and b are finite, x minus a or x minus b if b is infinite or a is infinite, or 1 if both. And so I won't show this, but it turns out that the only solutions are when fn is equal to the weight. So we'll just choose this. You might guess that we're missing some solutions. It turns out we're not. These are the only solutions. And so the generalized Rodriguez formula is this equation. Where Cn is just a normalization constant. So this is our formula. This is known as Rodriguez formula. So all the orthogonal polynomials can be written like this. But we haven't actually checked that what we get is a polynomial. So we make the wrong choice of a W, we might not get a polynomial. So the other thing we need to do is check when are these polynomials. And so there's actually only three cases to check. A, B is minus infinity to infinity. Zero to infinity. Or 0 to 1. If we have any other interval, we can just make a linear transformation. So Pn of Cx plus D will be a polynomial on one of these intervals. OK. So let's check case one. So in case one, A and B are minus infinity to infinity. Any linear transformation we do is just going to map us back to the same interval. So we're free to make a linear transformation in this case, because it won't change our interval. So let's make a linear transformation. So that P1 of x is plus or minus 2x, just for convenience. So if we compare this to our Rodriguez formula, we should have 1 over w times dw dx is equal to plus or minus 2x. And now this is a differential equation we can integrate directly. And if we do that, we'll get w of x is c times the exponential plus or minus x squared. Now, we need, for our construction to work, we needed y, which in this case was just w, to go to infinity, go to zero sufficiently fast at plus or minus infinity. So we have to choose the minus sign. so that y0 goes to 0 at plus or minus infinity. And so shouldn't call this c, call this k. K is, here is just some integration constant, which won't actually affect anything. It just cancels out of our formula. So we see, in this case, Gn of x is some normalization constant, Cn times e to the x squared ddn dx dn e to the minus x squared. And so we only check that p1 is a polynomial. But if p1 is a polynomial, we can see from this formula that all of the pn's will be polynomials. Every time we take their derivative, we're just bringing down 2x minus 2x, and the exponentials will cancel. After we're done taking derivatives. So the conventional choice is that cn is minus 1 to the n. And these are just the Hermite polynomials we saw before. And so you look at cases 2 and 3 in tutorial. Tomorrow. And you see that with just a little bit of effort, we've in fact classify all of the orthogonal polynomials. So these are the only ones on the real line, and on a semi-infinite or finite interval, there are just a few cases.
Another question.
Yes.
I didn't really understand what linear transformation you're imposing, and where you got p1 is plus or minus 2x.
Okay, so in general, what we would want, so in general, the most general linear polynomial would be, say, alpha x plus beta. And so what I've done is I've made a change of variables, because it won't change our interval. So if I choose, so p1 of x is alpha x plus beta, I can choose c and d such that cx plus d is plus or minus 2x. If I choose c and d appropriately, that's all I've done.
Okay. And then why do you start with order 1? Why not say p0 is some constant and go from there?
So if I started with p0, that would, so p0, given our formula here, if we take zero derivatives, s is 1 in this case. So then we just get cn times w over w. So that's always,
okay, so yeah,
always satisfied.
Okay.
So this is the simplest non-trivial case. And in fact, it's the only case we need to check, because we can see from our formula that we get all the rest. OK. So the last 15 minutes, I want to go through Parseval's theorem and just compute the zeta of 2, which will let us finish the calculation of zeta of minus 1 that we started on Thursday. Before we do that, I just want to talk briefly about something that's related to Parseval's theorem, which is the fact that orthogonal functions are very convenient for making approximations. So The best approximation to a function using n terms is just this formula, where an is un f, and un are orthonormal. So in what sense is it the best approximation? It minimizes the distance, delta n, with respect to the L2 norm between f and the partial sum. The minimum value is delta n is f squared minus sum of the coefficients squared. And so this is should be fairly intuitive. We do this all the time if we're approximating something using, say, a Fourier series. We compute the coefficients in our approximation just by taking the inner product of the function we want to approximate with the sine or cosine or complex exponential. And then we get the best possible approximation using that many terms in the Fourier series. So the nice thing about using orthogonal functions is that this coefficient only depends on un. So if we want to improve our approximation, we can just add more terms. We don't need to go back and recompute anything. All right. So Parseval's theorem just says what happens if we take n to infinity. So if a function space is complete, then f of x can be written as an infinite sum like this, and the sum converges. So in other words, if f is in the function space, which means has a finite norm, then delta n goes to 0 as n goes to infinity, or f squared is the sum from n equals 1 to infinity an squared. So let's look at an example to see how this works. So let's consider a wave with amplitude. F of x and period L. So that we can write f of x in terms of a Fourier series. And so what does Parseval's theorem say? So Parseval's theorem basically says that the total energy is the sum of the energies in each of the Fourier components. So the total energy would just be proportional to the amplitude squared. And the energy in each Fourier component is just proportional to the square of the coefficient. So basically says the intensity, which is proportional to the energy per unit length, which is this should be proportional to U, which is 1 over L integral from minus L over 2 to L over 2 f of x squared, which is the sum n equals minus infinity to infinity of a n squared. That's what Parseval's theorem says. So let's choose f of x to be equal to x, so that our function looks something like this. The period is L. And let's compute both sides of Parseval's theorem. So the integral for U is straightforward. It's just an integral of a polynomial, x squared. And if we do that integral, we just get 1 over L cubed over 3, which is L cubed over 12. L squared. Okay. So then to compute the sum, we need to compute what the AIs are first. And the zeroth one should be zero by symmetry. It's just an odd integral. But for any not equal to zero, we can write an as the integral minus L over 2 to L over 2. X e to the 2 pi I n x over L. And we can just write this as minus 1 over 2 pi I n times by throwing in a derivative acting on the exponential. Uh, And then we can integrate by parts. And we get three terms, two boundary terms, and it's integral. And the boundary terms just give us L over 2 e to the minus pi I n. And L over 2 e to the pi I n. Whereas this integral just gives us 0. It's not integral. Now we can, so these e to the I pi n's are just plus or minus 1. They'll have the same sign. So this e to the minus pi I n plus e to the pi I n over 2 just gives us minus 1 to the n plus 1. And we get, as our final result, L over 2 pi I n minus 1 to the n plus 1. Okay, so using Parseval, we see that L squared over 12 is the sum, and it's not 0 of L over 2 pi I n minus 1 to the n plus 1 squared, which can write as L squared over 4 pi squared sum from n equals 1 to infinity. We have two copies of that. The integral, the sum and is the same if we take n to minus n. And over here we recognize the zeta function. So we get, bring everything to the other side, pi squared over 6 is zeta of 2. And we can use that to result together with the functional equation for zeta to compute our first divergent sum. So remember, lambda of s is lambda of 1 minus s, and lambda of s was minus pi to the minus s over 2, gamma of s over 2, zeta of s. So we get that zeta of 2, gamma of 1, pi to the minus 1 equals zeta of minus 1, gamma of minus 1 half, pi to the 1 half. And this is just minus 2 root pi. Using some of the formulas for gamma we had before, the duplication and the functional equation. So we get zeta of minus 1 is minus 1/12, which was the sum of n All right, so this is our first diversion sum we've computed. And that's where we're going. So
what's lambda?
Lambda was this auxiliary function that it, so on Thursday we used, I stated the functional equation for zeta in terms of this function lambda, which was this product of zeta and gamma. So that's where we're going next. For the last two lectures, we'll talk about asymptotic series, which are usually divergent series. And we'll see how to compute them. Mainly, our main technique, and the most important one for applications to physics, at least theoretical physics, is the saddle point approximation. So we'll see how that the saddle point approximation is related to divergent series and asymptotic series. And so that's where we'll go for the last two lectures. Any questions?
All right, I'll see you tomorrow.